Good afternoon. It's Friday the 10th of May 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today in the studio, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. And joining us by video link, David Scott from Northern Exposure. So welcome to the programme, all. We're going to get straight on here because we're going to have a slightly shorter programme today. Well, here we go with the informal meeting of heads of state or government. And this is a European Council meeting taking place in Sibiu in Romania. Of course, that's Transylvania to you and me. Here we see King Donald, one of the four EU presidents. He is president of the European Council, walking around Sibiu, glad handing the local population and the media. So that's good stuff. And of course, naturally enough, they have to have a family photograph, the ubiquitous family photograph, Patrick. It's fantastic. I can see, who is that? Ms. Merkel there in green. That's fantastic stuff. It's the only one I can recognize.
And Federica in red, I believe.
Federica in red. Well,
Lady in red.
Well mentioned, Patrick, because she had something to say about this, which pretty much sets the scene for the event. Let's listen to her.
And today with the leaders we'll also discuss the responsibility that the European Union has in the world. Our partners in the region and globally see the European Union as a key player on which they rely. And I believe that internally we will need to reflect more on the need to strengthen our global role in a moment where the world needs the European Union leadership on so many different issues.
So, David, welcome to the programme. The world needs EU leadership on so many different issues. And they, in fact, produced a declaration, seemed to be written before the event.
Oh, I'm sure it was written before. They produced a declaration which reflects this, how much the world needs the EU and their partners, which refers principally to the states which border alongside Russia. They need the EU. Let's have a look at the declaration. All right, so here we have item, this is bullet point one. We will defend one Europe, ein Europe, from east to west, from north to south. 30 years ago, millions of people fought for their freedom and for unity and brought down the Iron Curtain, which had divided Europe for decades. There is no place for divisions that work against our collective interests. Put that in your pipe, Brexiteers, and smoke it.
That's a pretty strong position to be taking. It goes on. In fact, let's have a look at a couple of the other points. We will stay united through thick and thin. We will always look for joint solutions. We will protect our way of life, democracy, and the rule of law. I'm not entirely sure that they take that particular one very seriously, David.
No, or rather the words are changing, right? Democracy, yes, but voting doesn't matter and individual freedom doesn't matter. Democracy means something else. The rule of law, this is the global's rules-based order. That's not what you and I might understand by, say, something like the common law, because, of course, the common law has no place in the EU. So, yes, the words look familiar, but the meanings might be surprising.
Now, somebody else that was giving a press conference was Donald Tusk. So let's have a listen to what he had to say.
I can state one thing with complete certainty. The leaders have categorically demonstrated that they want to take full political responsibility, not only for single events or challenges, but for the European Union as a whole. Put simply, the member states and their democratically elected leaders want to actively shape the way the EU functions and develops.
Okay. Take it away.
That would be EU leadership, wouldn't it? This particular line's been coming out of the EU for some time. More and more concentration. It's the leaders say this. The leaders say this. The people, yes, we're sure they want it, but the leaders, this is what the leaders are doing. So there's a concentration on the views around that one table as representing the entire continent.
So then we have this from Euronews. Sibiu Summit, Future of Europe is about who we are and the model we can offer the world. And this is by Rodu Mogdan. Now, who is Rodu Mogdan?
Oh, he's a fine gentleman. I'll give you his CV, right? He is a global. He's Romanian. He's a global analyst, a consultant, a trainer, and think tanker, a problem solver, and he's passionate for power strategy and communications. So that's who he is. He was an advisor to Prime Minister as well. And the piece was fascinating. I encourage people to look at the whole of this. When he was talking about who we are and the global model we are offering, he says, in order to renew our unity and sense of purpose, we need to live and feel European again with everything this entails. There's a lot of kind of begging the question going on here. But anyway, and not just dictionary definition of how democracies should be. We need to know who we are and what we stand for and to continue leading the world in ecology, health and quality of life and to start harbouring global ambitions again. These ambitions do not necessarily have to be imperial. And he then goes on to say it's better to be power than prey. So not necessarily imperial. That's reassuring. And here he is again. And this is something that we're seeing again more and more. The successful future of Europe is a combination of European and national identities and pride driven by a clear agenda. Right, this is very interesting. He doesn't say what the agenda is. The agenda's hinted at, but it's never expressed in ways which anyone can understand. And they're trying to co-opt national pride, because national pride has been the point of resistance against the European superstate. They're now trying to co-opt national pride into it and say you can have European pride, you can have national pride, you can have regional pride. Right, so they're trying to take on board the, if you like, the more right-wing, the nationalist ideas that have been pushing back against the aggregation of power to one place, and they're trying to co-opt those forces and continue aggregating power into one place. And this comes, then we come to the motto of the whole meeting in Transylvania, and I was astounded when I saw this strength in unity. Does that ring any bells with you, Mike?
It does, David, but I mean, what are we looking at here? Is there a certain ideology starting to break surface?
I think that's exactly right. Break surface is exactly correct. It's been there all along, but now when they've hit some problems, Brexit, the populist movements, the yellow vests, there's lots of people criticising what they're doing. They're having to go down to the deeper underpinnings of the philosophy. And those deeper underpinnings are things like strength and unity, or as it used to be, strength through unity, which was the fascist motto. And the very symbol, the fascists, the very symbol of that was about strength through unity, because you had many, many sticks. Each one could be broken easily, but when they're all bound together, they're enormously strong. That was the point. And it was a symbol of strength through unity.
Yes. What are your thoughts on this?
I just comment on Mr. Radu, some of his comments that David highlighted there. He said, I'm passionate about power strategy and communications. I mean, who's passionate about that? If you put that on your CV when you're applying for a corporate job. So this is the corporate language. Then he says, it's better to be power than prey. Mm. That is absolutely quintessentially a fascist statement. I mean, so it seems the language is just, I mean, it's evident, Mike.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, look, let's bring in our own Stephen Barclay here, who's the Brexit secretary, because he was speaking at this event. Sibiu, he says, is an opportunity for us to consider the sustainable future relationship between the UK and the EU. So he said that he wasn't going to speak about Brexit. He was going to speak about other things, but one of the things that he wanted to do was to express that in terms of the sustainable future relationship between the UK and the EU after Britain leaves, if we ever do. And this is a very key point, because it demonstrates again that whatever anybody thinks in the minds of the government and our politicians, we are going to have a future relationship with the European Union, whether we have a period where we're out or not, whether we come out and go back in, or whether we never come out because we've got some kind of deal we're going to have a future relationship. So he's saying CBU is an opportunity for us to consider a sustainable future relationship between the UK and the EU. For as the political declaration itself says, we need to take account of the unique context between us. And he said that the UK has a role in terms of security and a role in terms of finance. So his speech was focusing on those two things, security and finance. And he began by saying this, as the UK Prime Minister has said, Europe's security is our security. Our commitment is to this is fundamental and unconditional. Now, as people have been watching the UK column will know, Theresa May has defined security in some of the documents that have been published by the British government. And it includes everything from judicial matters to defence to intelligence to policing and so on. European arrest warrant would come under that. OK, and so our commitment to that is fundamental and unconditional. Now, he did mention NATO. But he said that we will continue to use whatever is the most effective means, whether multinational, multilateral, smaller groups or bilateral relationships to safeguard our European security. And of course, when you look at the eight pillars of European defence, multilateral and bilateral relationships are one of the key pillars of European defence and European Defence Union. So that's what he's talking about when he's talking about security. Now, he went on to talk about finance. He said on finance, the UK has committed £5.8 billion in international climate finance from 2016 to 2020. We've established the world's first green investment bank and set the regulatory framework through the City of London to fund that investment through the Global Hub for Green Finance. He said, last year, my own water company in the eastern region became the first public utility company to issue a green bond, which is just one example of £19 billion in green finance bonds issued by the City of London. And I think what we're seeing here, Patrick and David, perhaps we're seeing the key ideological and the key policy areas that go with what David has just described with respect to the language that's being used. This is all about security, defence, green finance, Extinction Rebellion, this type of thing, going hand in hand in glove with the fascist ideology, the fascist language that we're seeing from them. They're expressions of the same thing, aren't they?
Yeah, so that you're seeing the end game here, Mike. So that is the Green New Deal is green bonds, is green derivatives. It's inflating the next big financial bubble because they've inflated and popped almost every possible bubble they can to absolutely destroy society while putting this economic system on life support. It's been on life support now for, you know, three decades. Mm-hmm. Okay, and this is their way of basically another shot of adrenaline and opioids into this dead carcass that is the fractional reserve global banking empire of bubbles. So this is the next green bubble. They'll pump it up, and then it will pop eventually after 10 or 15 years. And at that time, a lot of people are going to get extremely wealthy through that process. And nothing is going to change with regards to the climate or, you know, the environment for that matter.
Absolutely. David, just to close.
Just to go back to the security issue, I quite agree with what Patrick was saying on fractional reserve banking and the banking role. But back in 2017, Theresa May talking at the Eastern Area Partnership, she said the summit here today is all about taking stock and looking ahead to see how we can tackle the shared challenges together, both in security and development. We must be open-eyed about the actions of hostile states like Russia, who threaten the potential growth of the Eastern neighbourhood and who try to tear our collective strength apart. She added, I am looking forward today to renewed commitments from European countries to working together to tackle these shared challenges in both security and development. I'm here to say again that the UK is unconditionally committed to continuing to play our part, our leading role in maintaining Europe's security. So that was well after the Brexit vote. We are unconditionally committed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. OK, so, Patrick, let's move on to Iran now then.
So this is the big story, Mike, this week on the day, 1 year anniversary, May 8th, 2018, is when the U.S. Unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA so-called Iran nuclear deal, the joint deal between the P5 plus one and Iran. So Iran announced that it itself is going to withdraw from some of the agreements made in that. We'll go and highlight that in a minute, Mike. But what this has really brought up the question, which we'll discuss at the end of this, which is, the United States is in a position here where Iran is now basically calling their bluff. But what Iran is doing very cleverly, it seems, is putting the European Union, the European permanent members of the Security Council, between itself and the United States, forcing Europe to try to bring the U.S. back to the negotiating table. So let's look at how this is sort of playing out here. So we'll take a look. How is this happening? So basically, Iran is giving its European partners, mind you, the U.S. is already out of this deal. So they're not talking to Washington here directly. Okay, 60-day deadline for new terms to the nuclear accord, after which time Tehran will resume higher uranium enrichment and retain their sort of heavy water. Now, before this, they've been selling this on, or they've been trading it, bartering it for other things as part of this deal. Now they're saying, well, if we're not going to get relief, then we're going to pursue our own sort of goals with regards to enrichment. So they're asking the EU for economic compensation for a number of things, including the loss of businesses resulting from sanctions, which stem from the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA deal. So Iran's taken a hit. They've been promised billions of dollars by Europe. It hasn't arrived. So they're saying, well, show us the money, basically. So Iran will uphold its obligations, however, if European signatories to the deal uphold theirs. So they're basically saying Europe has not come good with its promises to Iran. So, and this is from the foreign minister, Zarif. He says, Iran's decision to partially withdraw from certain provisions do not violate the agreement. So they intend to stay within the framework of the agreement as a whole, Mike. But in terms of this one issue, and I'll explain why in a minute, they've said, no, this is not going to happen, basically. So this is Hassan Rouhani. This is the Iranian president, made this statement just a few days ago. So, and here's President Rouhani and his position on this is, we are ready to negotiate within the boundaries of the JCPOA, but it is not us who has left the negotiation table. He's talking to the United States right there, who are currently imposing a full economic embargo on Iran. So this is what's happening. So, and he goes on to clarify, we felt that the nuclear deal needs surgery, and the painkiller pills of last year have been ineffective. So this surgery is for saving the deal, not destroying it. And here's Secretary Mike Pompeo, who was only in the UK just a couple of days ago. He's saying, I urge the UK to stand with us, to rein in bloodletting and lawlessness, not to soothe the Ayatollahs angry at our decision to pull out of the nuclear deal. And Pompous continues, we agree that we are operating, that they are operating, in defiance of the UN ballistic missile resolution. We agree they fund terror across the Middle East. That's not true. That's a total lie. And across the world, another lie. We agree that they take hostages. I think the last time that Iran took hostages was in 1980, and those were students who took over the U.S. Embassy during the Iranian Revolution, or 79, I believe. Yeah. So how long ago was that, 1979? And it wasn't the country of Iran. It was revolutionary students. So, again, another kind of a lie by Pompeo there. And repress their own people is generally not specific about that. It has nothing to say about the United States' own economic repression of Iran through a full economic embargo. But that's our Secretary of State. So, sadly, this is our Secretary of State. And he just finished it off here, and I thought this was particularly egregious. Not far from here are the Churchill War Rooms. He's in London right now, where a leader of this great country stared evil in the face and recognized a threat that evil presented to the entire world. He's basically saying, I am Winston Churchill and Iran is Nazi Germany, is basically what he's saying there. Mm. What do you think of that, Mike?
Well, actually, if you go on to the next one, Patrick, because this is important too.
Well, this is Jeremy Hunt. This is the UK Foreign Secretary. So if they break that deal, he's talking to Iran, I believe, here, then there will be consequences in terms of how European powers react. So we urge the Iranians to think very long and hard before they break that deal. Use the same words again. We strongly urge them to reconsider them, what they said in their letter, basically.
Right.
So that's Jeremy Hunt.
So the reason I wanted you to move on to Jeremy Hunt was because it was really interesting watching the speech that Pompeo gave. Hunt introduced Mike Pompeo, and he said, you know, the position of Secretary of State has existed for whatever it is, 300 years, whatever it is. And he said, but the position of Foreign Secretary has existed for 50 years more than that. And really what he was saying to Mike Pompeo was, my job is senior to your job. That was what he was attempting to present. So I thought it was an interesting little dynamic, and I recommend everybody goes and have a listen to that speech that Pompeo gave, including what Patrick's just presented. Because it's a bit hard to take that type of rhetoric seriously when it's being delivered by Jeremy Hunt, frankly.
So Jeremy Hunt and Mike Pompeo are both on message saying that Iran has broken the deal.
Right.
The no talk about the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the whole thing, which they took years to negotiate, okay, in the last couple of years. Probably one of the most constructive and only positive things, I could say, foreign policy-wise, really, that the Obama administration achieved in 8 years. Certainly it was a good thing. However, I did a little research, Mike, and this decision by Iran didn't just come out of nowhere. This is basically the week before the U.S. basically filed to end waivers that allowed Iran to exchange its enriched uranium for unrefined yellow cake uranium from Russia. So it had an exchange deal with Russia, and there was a U.S. sanctioned waiver on that, basically. And so not only that, but to sell its heavy water, which is used as a coolant for nuclear reactors, it was selling that to Oman, I believe, okay? So the U.S. has intervened only weeks before to stop that from happening, which was a key, that was a key mechanism that allowed Iran to sell its enriched uranium. So if you take that away, what's Iran, what other options do they have? So they're saying, no, we're going to build up our stockpile of enriched uranium and heavy water if you're not going to let us sell it or barter for it, basically.
David, it seems to me here that what's going on is that the U.S. is doing everything that it possibly can to set Iran up for a fall.
It is something like that. The U.S. is responding to, I think, a lot of initiatives from Israel. And there seems to be a decision that we are going to ramp up the tension and ramp up the tension. What's the overall plan here? It doesn't seem at all clear. There's certainly, the messages are certainly originating in Israel. If you start following the BICOM feed, that is giving the absolutely up-to-date viewpoint from an Israeli perspective as to what is happening here. And what we're seeing there is there's saber rattling over Iran, which is more or less constant. And there is a constant push towards the US and towards the United States president to encourage more action and less restraint and less caution all of the time.
And just quickly, what's Europe saying about this? Germany saying, we have great concern, a dynamic statement by Germany, as expected. France, Macron saying it's a good deal, the JCPOA, said, but we want to include the missiles in the deal. So they want to restrict Iran's ability to have medium-range inner ballistic missiles. So, and that's interesting because that's exactly what Mike Pompeo put in his statement. Mm-hmm. So this, clearly the United States is pushing this right to the edge to try to renegotiate this deal to sort of take the missiles out, basically. And as people might not be aware, Iran has used that in Syria a few times to hit ISIS targets or to hit Al-Qaeda targets. They've lobbed a couple of missiles on a few occasions, okay? So this is seen as a big security threat. So Macron, the United States, everybody, I think behind the scenes, this is also something that's at play right here. So, but let's...
Well, look, we're going to have to move on from this, Patrick, but I mean, what's going on? Let's put this one up.
I'll go quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, just to add here, okay, the United States has also put an embargo on steel, iron, aluminium, and copper. Additional sanctions this week. So a full embargo attacking countries who are buying Iranian oil. So they're doing to Iran what the United States did to Japan before the Second World War, if anybody is interested or not in that. And by the way, David's right. I think the so-called intelligence of that triggered the U.S. carrier action into the Persian Gulf seems to have originated in Israel. Mm. And that's from the source I have on that is the Times of Israel. I'm taking a statement here from an Israeli official. Clearly, I think the United States is getting its intelligence marching orders from Tel Aviv directly. So the big question, Mike, on that is whose foreign policy? The United States has to decide. Is it Israel's foreign policy? Or is it the U.S. foreign policy? Is it America first or is it Israel first? Because Benjamin Netanyahu boasted that it was him who convinced Trump to ditch the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal. He boasted publicly last summer about that. So there's no question who is dictating U.S. foreign policy. This is potentially a very dangerous situation. Mm. So we'll keep an eye on that.
Okay. Now, what's going on in Venezuela?
This is just an extraordinary story, Mike. This is the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. It's literally under siege. So the Juan Guaido supporters have been trying to basically invade and hijack the embassy, and American activists called Embassy Protectors, a whole coalition of anti-war groups, including Code Pink, Answer Coalition, and many others, are occupying the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., and there's a few great independent journalists who are inside there, and this is an amazing story here. This is Alex Rubenstein, who's somebody you want to follow on Twitter on this story. They've cut off electricity and water. Here's the officials here going on White House orders here to cut off the water into the embassy, the electricity as well. So they won't allow food in, Mike. They have Guaido thugs outside. You can see in this, they've been filmed, basically keeping people from bringing food in, and the police aren't doing anything. They're letting them rough up activists. They're letting them beat up the delivery man from the food. And they've even, well, I'll show you a story in a second that's pretty shocking. So they're doing exactly to the embassy in Washington, D.C., what they're doing to Venezuela as a country economically and diplomatically. It's absolutely extraordinary. And this is another independent journalist here, Anya Parampil. She's live streaming from inside the Venezuelan embassy, and it's just amazing. She live streamed the police basically throwing down a 70-year-old man, the president of Veterans for Peace in the United States. So she actually filmed that. It's a really amazing coverage here. These are people that you want to follow on Twitter and watch this because I'm not sure this could come to a head pretty soon, Mike. So this is amazing. So the so-called self-proclaimed interim president, Juan Guaido, that Washington recognizes as president, but nobody in Venezuela, aside from a few people, do. His supporters are wanting to take over the embassy in the United States from the government, basically, the legitimate government of Venezuela. So this is incredible. And I'll just add here, this is Ray McGovern. Jerry Condon, 70-year-old president of Veterans for Peace, was roughed up and thrown to the pavement on camera. And Ray McGovern's talking about this on Consortium News right here. So it's an absolutely incredible story, Mike.
David, in the context of the EU, we once again had the language that they are upholding the rule of law. Britain says this, Washington says this as well. This type of siege on an embassy, it seems like there's a limitation on this idea of the rule of law here.
Well, it doesn't apply if it's inside the continental United States, for a start. It has also been quite noticeable that the EU has been intervening in the Venezuela crisis. And we've had comments and statements from Ms. Mogherini on this very subject. So we're seeing them flexing a worldwide political and soon to be military capability. But it doesn't apply to certain players. Russia's always bad, America's always benign. Those are the fixed points in the worldview at the moment.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Look, we're pretty much out of time, but David, we'll just end with this story from Scotland. This is the Times here, child abuse inquiry to look at Crown Office failings. Is it really going to do that, or is this just another throwaway headline?
Oh, that's an excellent question. The child abuse inquiry to look at Crown Office failings. Now, there have certainly been Crown Office failings. The Crown Office is organised crime is a phrase that keeps coming up. The Crown Office are the only means of any prosecution in Scotland. All prosecution is through the Crown Office. Therefore, anything that's not prosecuted is held up. It happens in the Crown Office. It's a completely obscure organisation. We don't have any access. It's all confidential. You don't know what's happening in there. And of the cases that the police investigate that are considered to have a good prospect of a successful conviction, 40% of those are decided by the Crown Office to not be cases they want to take forward and never see the light of a day in a courtroom. 40% is in this discard pile. So there are many things about the Crown Office that are very worrying. Now, there are also many things about the official inquiry that are very worrying. The Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal, this is from the Times report, Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service admitted it was likely to be the focus of future investigation by the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry. The officials conceded that the body may have been deficient in the past. Notice it's always in the past. It is anticipated that future stages of inquiry will require the institutions charged with the investigation and prosecution of crime to face up candidly and critically to the practices and policies of years gone by. Again, it's always painted, it's perfect now, but it wasn't then. And there's no explanation as to how this miraculous change ever happened. But it goes on. This comes after John Halley, a lawyer appointed to the inquiry, suggested that vulnerable young people in care were being let down, raising his concern about child trafficking through prostitution of children in care in a report sent to Lady Smith, the inquiry's chairwoman. Mr. Halley cited several cases that never came to court, despite evidence of trafficking and sexual abuse of children in care. The Sunday Times reported, some victims were linked to senior figures within the legal establishment. Senior lawyers, senior judiciary is what that means. And Mr. Halley said, I will not be complicit in nor tolerate cover-ups and failure to report and to investigate systemic failures. Now, Mr. Halley was junior counsel to the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry, and he put the following statement on Twitter, which I will read in full if I may, because it's absolutely vital. He wrote, I have been absent from work since the 28th of October 2016. On the 10th of October 2016, I was diagnosed with bowel cancer. On the 31st of October 2016, I underwent a right hemicolonectomy in surgery lasting some 4 hours at Borders General Hospital, Scotland. Between 6 September 2016 and June 2017, I underwent 8 cycles of chemotherapy. I have been unable to return to work since then. Prior to and after my diagnosis of cancer, I have held an appointment as lead junior counsel to the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry. On the 1st of April 2019, I submitted a detailed note running to in excess of 17,500 words on child trafficking through prostitution of children in care in Scotland to Lady Smith, chair of the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry. By letter dated 25th of April 2019, Julianne Jameson, Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry's secretary, informed me that Lady Smith has decided that the note is comprised of material that I ought not to have been working on. I refute that entirely. I was instructed and I did investigate and report. The note sets out a summary of my remit, important facts, allegations, inferences and sources for investigation by the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry. It is clear to me that Lady Smith has decided that the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry will not investigate the material detailed in the note. He goes on, since September 1, 2016, I've had to suffer disability discrimination, harassment and victimisation by Lady Smith. I will deal with this in an application to employment tribunal when I'm well enough. However, I will not be complicit in nor tolerate cover up or failure to report or investigate systemic failures, including prosecution policy failures, which appear to have been perpetrated injustice on vulnerable young people in Cairn, Scotland. I will not permit the serious allegations detailed in my note of past child exploitation and failures to report suspicions of child exploitation by lawyers, judges, public figures and others to be ignored. I have today reported my note to Mr. Graham Fraser, Procurator Fiscal for Scottish Borders Area. I understand that the Procurator Fiscal will report the note and its content directly to the Lord Advocate if, having considered its content, he is satisfied of the duty to do so. I have felt compelled to immediately report the note to the Procurator Fiscal in the public interest. However, this is spun, the facts remain. In order to ensure necessary safeguarding of our children going forward, Scotland and our survivors of child abuse require the truth. So Lady Smith has been asked to investigate the Procurator Fiscal Service because the Procurator Fiscal Service has let down the survivors of child sexual abuse. Meanwhile, the Procurator Fiscal Service has been asked to investigate a case where Lady Smith has let down the survivors of child sexual abuse. And out of this, we hope for truth and justice. It does not look good.
No, it doesn't, David. Well, look, on that note, we'll have to leave it for today. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Patrick.
And just one last comment that we didn't have time to get to, but I'll say very quickly. The Sweden is going to announce next week whether they're going to revive the sexual assault case with Julian Assange. If they do go forward with that, and that is going to happen, we don't know. We'll discuss it on the extra time after the program. But that means that he will be extradited to Sweden. And then from there, who knows, probably to the United States later. We don't know. But that is a possibility, I just wanted to say.
Yes.
So we will report on that next week.
Yeah, and we'll be talking about it during extra time as well.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, look, thank you very much, Patrick, for joining us. Thank you for joining us. Slightly shorter news program today. We're heading off to AV10 right now. And that's going to be a particularly interesting weekend, I'm sure.
And if you're not going to AV10, but you do want to watch it, I do want to tell people, go to 21st Century Wire, and you can click on and purchase a ticket for the live stream. You can watch it all weekend live at AV10, no matter where in the world you are. So that's something for people to consider as well. Go to 21stcenturywire.com, click on the AV10 live stream banner.
Okay, so that's it for today. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back, in fact, no news program on Monday because we'll still be at AV10.
But we'll be broadcasting the Sunday Wire as well on Sunday Live from AV10 in Milton Keynes.
Absolutely, as usual. So we'll be back with the UK Column News on Wednesday, 1 p.m. We will see you then. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.